Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, a great talk Glenn Ford recently gave at Trinity College. It's about the decline of imperialism and why the United States is fighting wars everywhere, and what does this have to do with the price of tea in China? Well, it's not exactly the tea, but it's definitely China. I hope you'll stay tuned. On April 6, Glenn Ford spoke at Trinity College here in Hartford, Connecticut. Ford is one of the most powerful black voices on the political left, and his talk was not only powerful, but intellectually brilliant. It was titled, Imperialism Hopping on Just One Leg. It's over an hour long, and we'll broadcast it complete over three installments of New World Notes. It's that good. Ford explains the reasons behind our government's smashing of civil liberties at home and its constant wars abroad, especially its constant new drone wars abroad. There are some interconnected causes for all this. One is the victory of finance capital over manufacturing capital in the United States. As Ford sees it, to keep itself rich, Wall Street is selling off American manufacturing. That's leaving the U.S. with less and less economic clout in the world, even less financial clout. So, military clout is the only clout the U.S. has left. To protect corporate profits, that's what we're using. Another reason for all this militarism is the rise of China. It's rising back to its historically normal position as the world's greatest economic power. U.S. corporations are not even trying to compete with China for the world's business. To protect their own profits, they're calling in the U.S. military to check China's economic advancement in other countries, and especially in Africa. That's what AFRICOM is all about. It's all about China. In this first part of his talk, Ford starts in the present, skips back to 1492, and brings us up to the late 20th century with the victory of finance over manufacturing. Speaking in Hartford on April 6, here is Glenn Ford.
I want to take a long view of history this evening to put the current era in context. So it's going to take me a little while to get to Mr. Obama. It's very, very difficult to talk about history and to talk about political economy in the United States, because the American conversation is dominated by mythology and not by facts. Facts make most Americans very uncomfortable, and so those facts are often unwelcome in the conversation. I'm going to begin by stating a huge fact, a fact that I think shapes the political geography of our time. It is a fact that has everything to do with why the United States is methodically waging war against peace and against the very concept of the rule of law on this planet. That fact is that by the end of the year 2016, China will surpass the United States as the world's biggest economy. Now, that is according to the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, which is comprised of all of the world's richest countries. The International Monetary Fund also agrees that 2016 is the date. The U.S. intelligence services, they disagree, or they claim or pretend to disagree. They say that China will not be number one until the year 2030. And I suppose that they want to give Americans a few more years to catch up with the reality. They don't want to panic them. A substantial body of economists believes that China has already surpassed the United States and became number one, the number one economy in the world, back in 2010. And that's based on a different way of measuring economic activity. Of course, if we were just talking about the phenomenal growth of China, that would be one thing. That would be a different conversation. But it's not just China. Brazil has also grown explosively. Its development bank, the Development Bank of Brazil, is now bigger than the World Bank. And this in a country that only, it seems like yesterday, was considered part of the third world. And now its bank is bigger than the capitalist bank. Even U.S. intelligence agencies now predict that Asia will surpass the economies of the United States and of Europe combined by the year 2030. And we're not even talking about the economies of South America and the economies of African countries. And in those places, China is already the major trading partner. So the economic eclipse of the United States, of Europe and North America, by what used to be called the Third World, the world that was formerly colonized and super exploited by the Europeans and by the United States, is essentially an accomplished fact today in the year 2013. This is a far different world than when I was born. After World War II, the United States accounted for more than 60% of all the world's manufactured goods. Today, Asia, and specifically China, is the center of global manufacturing. And the powers that rule in the United States and in Europe are desperately trying to figure out how they can maintain their dominance in the world, in a world that they don't produce as much as their former colonies, their former vassal states do. A world in which the United States has few advantages besides their control over the world's financial institutions, like the World Bank, and their huge war machines, which is their primary advantage. The great crisis facing U.S. imperialism and all those junior imperialists of the old Europe is the rise of Brazil and India and, most importantly, China and many other members of what we used to call the Third World. Actually, China has been the world's biggest economy for most of the last 2,000 years. The great European breakout of 1492, that's the way I describe it, was all about getting access to China. The Western Hemisphere was an unexpected speed bump on the way to a Western route to China. The Europeans jockeyed and schemed, and they fought among themselves for centuries for the privilege of tapping into China's mother load of an economy. And for a long time, their biggest problem in terms of the China trade was that they didn't make anything that the Chinese wanted. And then the Spanish discovered a mountain of silver in South America. About half of that silver went to China. That's the part that's usually not talked about when discussing this silver load in South America. And China needed that silver, half of it finally consuming, because it needed precious metals to make for its currency because of its huge economy. Millions of Native Americans died digging out that silver. 95% of the people of the Americas died in the wake of the European breakout, part of the global Holocaust in a 500-year war of Western Europe against the rest of the world. This was a war that lasted and is still going on, but that lasted half of a millennium. Untold millions of Africans died or were transplanted and enslaved in that 500 years war. Whole peoples were extinguished. The entire map of the earth was redrawn as spoils of war for one tiny portion of mankind. Most of the world was reduced to pirate booty for a handful of nations who had perfected the arts of war and plunder and mass enslavement. They grew relatively rich as the rest of the world was made much poorer. Until about two centuries ago, the living standards of most people in the world were about the same. It is this rape and plunder and constant warfare that elevated Europe above the rest of the world. India was, for example, the manufacturing center of the world until about the mid-1700s, until about the time of the American Revolution. India accounted for 25% of all of the world's manufactured goods, and that mostly consisted of textiles. Then the English came around. In a few generations, it was the Indians who were wearing English cloth. Western Europe, in its 500-year war, systematically underdeveloped the rest of the planet. It became rich from the resources and the labor of the rest of the planet, and they called that progress. And because Europe became rich and powerful, it then invented the ideology of racism in order to justify its domination of the darker peoples of the world. The United States was a product of that great European breakout and of that 500-year war. According to Yale history professor David Blight, by the time of the outbreak of the American Civil War, slaves as an asset were worth more than all of America's manufacturing, worth more than its railroads, worth more than all of the productive capacity of the United States put together. Slaves, according to Professor Blight, were the single largest by far financial asset of property in the entire American economy. The only thing that was worth more than the slaves was the land of the United States itself. And we all know where the United States got that land. So the wealth of the United States in the period just preceding this country's great leap into a manufacturing giant was based on stolen land and the labor of stolen people. The United States and its competitors in Europe had grown rich from plunder through force of arms. In Marxist terms, we call that a kind of primitive accumulation, just taking stuff. Through this organized theft and coercive, one-sided, point-of-the-bayonet terms of trade, Europe and the United States accumulated the surpluses that allowed them to build a fully developed capitalist system. And this great industrial capacity then allowed them to grow stronger still. In 1885, the Europeans and the United States came together for a great conference in Berlin to divide up the whole world among themselves. You may associate the Berlin Conference with the scramble for Africa, and it was a scramble for Africa. But the boundary lines and the spheres of influence that were drawn at that conference covered the entire planet. It covered Asia and Africa and even contested parts of Europe. Latin America was largely left alone as a sphere of influence of the United States, which would repeatedly invade its neighbors in the succeeding decades after 1885. Japan had not yet joined this imperial club, but it knew that it had to join or be gobbled up as just another pawn in the Euro-American chessboard. 30 years after the Berlin Conference, the Europeans and the United States would engage in the First World War, largely to redraw the lines that were laid down at the 1885 Berlin Conference. And out of that war would come the League of Nations as an attempt to impose some kind of global law and order on the planet. But it was not going to be a law and order among equals. Rather, It sought to create a framework in which the Europeans and the Americans and now the Japanese would not kill each other in such great numbers as they had in the First World War, in battles over who would rule the lesser peoples of the world. But the colonized people would have no protections under that League of Nations. Except for Japan, which had defeated Russia in a spectacular naval battle back in 1905, the League of Nations was effectively a white man's club. We know that the major players in the League of Nations thought of it as a white man's club. And we know that because, well, Woodrow Wilson was an avid, enthusiastic supporter of the League of Nations. He was also the Dixiecrat who was the most overt and obnoxious racist president of the 20th century. He's the one who instituted segregation in the federal civil service, putting up whites-only bathrooms and just firing a whole departments of black people. So we know that he would not support a League of Nations unless it was a white man's club. The League of Nations never seriously contemplated recognizing the national rights of the world's colonized peoples. The great powers were themselves colonial powers, and that, of course, included the United States after 1898. And then came World War II, which ended with the United States as the only intact major industrial power on the planet. Europe was in ruins, Japan was in ruins, and even the new nemesis of the United States, the Soviet Union, was in ruins. But the United States was, by default, home to three-fifths of the manufacturing capacity of the entire world. The Americans were not the most liberal of the World War II allies. The U.S. was, in the 1940s, an apartheid state, and its policy towards its Latin American neighbors was always thoroughly racist to the core. But there was a new world dawning, and the new superpower was going to take advantage of these new conditions. By default, the United States had emerged from that war as the global hegemon. The whole world, in fact, was the United States' oyster. It had the bomb, and that was the trump card. It had the only currency that was backed by an economy that was strong enough to anchor the world capitalist system. And everybody owed the United States money. The old powers of Europe were on their backs, and the colonized people knew that their European masters were on their backs. And they were agitating as never before for independence. And, of course, there was the Soviet Union and the possibility that the Soviets might help the Third World, the colonized people, achieve that independence. The powers that be in the United States decided, why should Washington allow the worn-out and beat-down Europeans to continue to monopolize trade in their colonies, which were going to attain independence, at least nominal independence anyway? Decolonization, it was thought in Washington at that time, presented a wonderful economic opportunity for the United States. And why give the Soviet Union the moral higher ground by appearing to side with the old order on the question of the rights of nations to be free and independent? That was not acceptable. After all, the United States was at that time, with 60% of the manufacturing capacity of the world, big enough and strong enough and had enough economic clout to manage, it thought, this independence of the colonized country's process. It had the soft power in terms of its economic might and in terms of the words of the U.S. Constitution, and it had the hard power, the guns and the planes and the bombs, and especially the atomic bomb. So the United States, decided to take the lead in codifying the rights of human beings and the rights of nations, rights that these newly emerging peoples believed and expected they would come to enjoy themselves, just like their masters had. The new United Nations and the various Geneva Accords set in what we thought was stone the rules of war. And those rules were centered on the sovereignty of nation states. That is the bedrock of international law. Aggressive war was deemed to be a capital international crime. Waging war against peace, which is the crime for which the Nazis were hanged after the trials at Nuremberg, was outlawed by this new United Nations configuration. And all this was fine and dandy for the United States because it was sitting on top of the world in the 1940s. It was the unchallenged economic hegemon, and it was the first nuclear power. Now, that didn't mean that the United States did not violate international law. It did so with regularity. It did so overtly in Vietnam and other places. It did so covertly, although in plain sight, in subversions against Iran and against Cuba. It imposed dictatorships throughout Latin America, and it has a murderous record in Africa, including the assassination of Patrice Lumumba. But it did continue to give lip service to this body of international law that was supposed to respect the rights of peoples and nations and supposed to outlaw war except as the very last resort, something that's not supposed to be resorted to except in cases of aggression from an outside party. There is, however, another kind of law, and that is the law of political economy. Those laws, the laws of political economy, dictate that under capitalism there will inevitably come diminishing returns on investment, that is, lower profits. And this will cause crises that threaten to collapse the system. This is a fundamental contradiction of capitalism. Capitalism has found ways to deal with that contradiction in the course of its development. One of the most important ways that this contradiction was dealt with for the imperial powers was to export the contradiction by extracting super profits from the peoples of the colonized countries by the simple theft of land and resources. The colonies gave the big capitalists a chance to make a big buck where they couldn't do that at home. And so that's the exportation of the contradiction. The other way to at least temporarily resolve the contradiction of diminishing returns is through war, because at the end of the war, you get to take the other guy's stuff, including his colonies. You get to reset the game board if you are a winner. The United States and the Europeans began feeling the contradiction of diminishing returns in the late 60s and the early 70s. But by then, most of the colonies had become at least nominally independent, and the geopolitical competition with the Soviet Union was intensifying. The world was in a mood for revolution, and it wasn't so easy for the United States to control events or for the U.S. and the Europeans to export their economic contradictions to their former colonies, which were now called the Third World. The United States had also been humiliated by a small nation, Vietnam, a fact that constrained its ability to act as the world bully. And most of us remember that after that defeat in Vietnam, we saw a period of, it almost looked humble for the bully in the 70s and up to the Soviet intervention in Afghanistan. By the mid-70s, something else was occurring, and I think it was quite profound. Something was happening that I don't believe has happened ever before in the history of the world, at least not in this particular way. The banks and Wall Street were finally winning what had been, always under capitalism, a long struggle internally, a long struggle between finance and manufacturing capital. There have always been conflicts between finance capital and manufacturing capital. Manufacturing capital invests in labor and things, and finance capital plays with money. The old saying used to go that what was good for General Motors is good for the country. But by the early 1980s, the finance division of General Motors was raking in more profits than the car-making division of General Motors. There was the handwriting on the wall for all to see if you were looking. Finance capital, and that means the banks and Wall Street, and they used to be separate, now they are the same. Finance capital was on top of what was still, by far, the most powerful economy in the world. This set in motion an era in which we started to hear about globalization. We heard that the world was going to change and change drastically. And it was all said in a very celebratory sense. All of the news media, all of the corporate media were heralding the new age of globalization, and they were all telling us that this age was inevitable and it was a very, very good thing. And that was the signal that the lords of capital, that is Wall Street, had made a very important and pivotal decision. They had decided that they would dismantle the industrial capacity of the United States piece by piece. That's what they meant by globalization.
Glenn Ford, speaking in Hartford on April 6. Imperialism hopping on just one leg. The talk was videotaped by Stan Heller of The Struggle, www.thestruggle.org. We are New World Notes, and I thank you for listening. Catch up on any of our shows you may have missed at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. That's newworldnotes.blogspot.com. And please come back next week for more of Glenn Ford's very interesting take on what the heck is the United States doing in the world and why are they doing it. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust advising illegitimi non carborundum, question authority, and please tune in again. Ciao.